Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hello, I'm Stephen.
And I'm Anoush.
Yes, Helen's on holiday, but in an exciting jam-packed episode, we've got...
Labour's Brexit policy.
Looking back at the election a year on.
And crumbling Britain, are potholes political?
And keep an eye out, or an ear out, at the end of the programme for a special snippet of our culture podcast, The Back Half. Hello. If you are already behind the NS paywall, you will be listening to this on Wednesday evening, hours after we've gone to press.
Gone to Audible.
Please do send your suggestions for what the podcast equivalent of going to press is. And you also get a new Sunday newsletter from me in which I look forward to the week ahead. There's a little bit of culture in it, a little bit of what we're listening to. There's two exclusive subscriber-only playlists of what people in the NS are listening to. And there will also be a restaurant review. I'm going to start reviewing a restaurant every week. And also, because I want to get out of London for this, if you, you know, live not in London, I'm sorry. But also do recommend places I should go. Yeah, it's a really fun thing. And of course, you also get everything on the website, the magazine, in advance of it hitting newsstands on Wednesday evening. And if you go to newstatesman.com/NS subscribers on Wednesday evening, you will get the early episode there. If you are not a subscriber and you go to that address, I assume a pop-up will appear going, "Oi mate, what are you doing?" And if you click on it to sign up, then our clever software will know that you've signed up to listen to the New Statesman podcast, and I will be able to buy a gold jacuzzi. So you should do that. On the subject of gold jacuzzis, I don't know how this EEA segue is going to work. I have not thought this through. But on the subject of gold... on the subject of gold jacuzzis, something we would all like, but we're not going to have, is Britain going into the...
You saved it. What a segue.
Into the European Economic Area. So could you just briefly go through what is happening next Tuesday in the House of Commons and what Labour's new amendments last position is?
Yeah, sure. So we're going to see the sort of crunch votes on the withdrawal bill. And obviously we've had the House of Lords amendments that have defeated the government and are now going back to the Commons for the MPs to vote on them. Now, one of these is keeping Britain in a European economic area, so a sort of Norway-style arrangement with the EU. All the Remainers among MPs and others are very enthusiastic about this option, but it doesn't look like there's a majority in the Commons to pass it. So there's a lot of Labour MPs who are angry with their leadership for not backing this option and making it Labour's policy and trying to defeat the government on this in the Commons. Instead, the Labour front bench has just announced a new amendment keeping Britain in the European Union's internal market, but not going so far as the Lords Amendment to keep the UK in the EEA. That's where we're at. Lots of people are saying this. It looks like Labour's completely softened its Brexit stance, but you have a different interpretation of what this move means, don't you, Stephen?
Yes. I mean, if you want to understand some of the policy undercurrents, you should read the IPPR's Shared Market Report, which this bears, it's not its own influence, but this very much does bear the imprint of that report. it's two things. It's a change of emphasis, but it actually really reiterates Labour's existing position, which is full tariff-free, frictionless access with rule sharing and within the rules-based architecture. There are specific opt-outs Labour wants from the European Court of Justice, which are part of why they don't want to be in the, why the leadership doesn't want to be in the EEA. All right, there are basically three. Oh, it's that moment on a podcast when I commit to a numbered list.
Oh.
Three objections the leader's office has. The first, there are specific things about the, they don't want to be a rule taker, not a rule maker. Now, one of the things I am reluctantly forced to agree with both Theresa May and the leader's office about is that they are right, A, in terms of the referendum, but B, in terms of the United Kingdom's sense of itself. Politico's Jack Blanchard, author of Westminster's second best morning email. I mean, actually, who am I kidding? It's so good. But mine is better and you should subscribe. But it, you know, did this great in conversation with the Norwegian Prime Minister. And she basically said, well, yeah, it's frustrating not being at the, you know, the top table with negotiations, but you've got to put businesses and family first. Now, I agree with that sentiment, but the ultimately for the United Kingdom as a polity to be able to accept that long term, that would require a very profound and radical shift, both in how British politicians see Britain in the world and also how British voters see Britain in the world. And I think those, I think maybe one of those things might happen, but I think it's highly unlikely that both of those things will happen. The second problem is freedom of movement. Now, obviously, no one in Jeremy Corbyn's office or indeed that core four of John Trickett, John McDonnell and Diane Abbott is particularly fussed by the free movement of people. However, they are all aware that opposition to free movement of people was a key part of the referendum. And you can't be in the EEA and have the free and be out of the free movement of people. So from that perspective, it's nothing doing. And the third objection to the EEA is that the EEA has specific opt-outs for Norway's economic model and Norway's political. They, you know, the leader's office belief is that they, then while an EEA type arrangement is a good destination, it should not be the EEA. Now, you can, in my view, fairly and correctly say that the things the leader's office are asking for and the thing that Keir Starmer is asking for in an internal market are things that are less acceptable to the EU as it currently is constituted and the politics of those of the individual member states than they were when Norway negotiated the EEA, partly because there's a big difference between a country that, so in Norway, the political class wanted to go in, they were rejected in a referendum. And basically what happened was is the Norwegian political class went, could you make something for us that is basically EU membership? There's a lot more goodwill towards a country which wants to get closer but can't than a country which wants to move further away and has had a conservative government having a kind of weird, you know, existential, maybe with a Max Fax, maybe with a whatever the other one is. And so there are just lots of different, there are lots and lots of reasons why I don't think what they want to do is achievable. However, there's also a tactical thing here, which is to find a way to kill the EEA amendment. You mind just talking us through what the EEA amendment is?
Yeah, so the EEA amendment, it had a majority in the Lords, and so it passed. And so that was yet another defeat for the government there. And MPs who are in favour of a softer Brexit looked at that and thought, if only we could replicate that in the Commons. But there isn't a majority there, as we've both of us, I think, have written before. So the Labour front bench doesn't want it. A lot of backbenchers don't want it. And it's the same on the government side as well. And so there's not really, I don't know why there's such a fixation on this, because there's not a way that it would pass.
Yeah. So one of the weird things when I send out my key morning email is whenever I say, and again, as we've both written, I think probably more times than either of us want to think about, that the number of Labour MPs who will vote against keeping us in the EEA, regardless of what the Labour whip is larger than the number. Well, it's not larger than the number of Tory rebels, but seeing as you need to net have seven Tory rebels to defeat the government, at the moment there are 12 signatories to 12 Tory signatories to the cross-party EEA amendment. Well, the bad news is there are more than seven Labour MPs. There's the seven Labour leavers. There's Caroline Flint, there's John Speller, And there are other sort of people who have not, you know, put themselves about as much. But there are that, yeah, there are already. So it's one of
those. So Labour MPs who aren't necessarily Eurosceptics, but can't commit the UK into an agreement that would mean free movement because they live in constituencies where that wouldn't be countenance.
Yeah. And I think the thing I find bizarre about it is every time I write this, I get at least one angry text or message back from a pro-European Labour MP saying this is not true. However, the other thing which happened is I get three texts back from other Labour MPs going either going, yeah, I'm not voting for the EEA. Are you on glue? Or I'd like to make it clear, I'm paraphrasing. No Labour MP has ever asked if other Labour MPs are on glue, to my knowledge. or you then get people, you know, kind of sort of Keir Starmer's supporters club within the Tribune group of MPs who, with a couple of exceptions, think Keir is doing a great job in very difficult circumstances, who are willing to say, yeah, this is exactly right. Keir is managing a lot of different sort of groupings within both the front bench and the back benches very well. I think Corbyn's a bit of a crutch for pro-European people on the centre-left. I mean, partly because it is quite easy, candidly, I'll front up, I think, it is a lot easier for me to countenance as an idea, oh, well, just get rid of Corbyn and have, you know, someone who cries whenever Ode to Joy plays as leader of the Labour Party.
Of happiness.
Yeah. Not like Corbyn cries. And that's easy for me because it's not ideologically uncomfortable as a solution. I don't particularly think like, oh, well, I worry I'd have to say goodbye to the things about Corbyn's platform that I like. I think I'd be able to keep those. And it doesn't bother me. And I think that is where most centre-left Remainers are. However, it doesn't actually fix the problem. And it's a much more uncomfortable question to go, well, what are you going to do about Caroline Flynn then? What are you going to do about John Speller? What are you going to do about, what is your plan to stop these other people rebelling? Not least, of course, the other thing it forgets is if you have no Corbyn, then you have someone although Corbyn is not particularly pro-European now, his position is a lot more pro-European than it would otherwise be because he wants to defeat the government in the House of Commons, right? And the whole thing, we were talking about beforehand because I'm starting to think maybe I'm going mad because I cannot work out why people think the EEA amendment can pass, right? It can't. Like, you cannot get to 325 names.
No, I can't see it happening. I suppose what those MPs who do argue that would say is if Jeremy Corbyn took this as an option, as you know, and we did have people like Tom Watson, deputy leader, fairly recently saying it was still on the table. And, you know, they might have thought that was an opportunity and that if the leader's office did go for that, then other Labour MPs who might have been on the fence would follow suit. So I can see that they thought that Jeremy Corbyn could be a sort of master of that destiny. But actually, I do think a lot of the complaints about him from MPs who oppose him is that he's not properly opposing the government, whereas he is, you know, he's making these amendments to make life difficult for them. So he is doing that job.
Yeah, I think a lot of the time, I think there are two reasons why people say they don't understand Labour's Brexit strategy. One is in the cases of some journalists, they just do not seem to talk to the leader's office very often. But I think the second is a lot of the time people are, I don't think they're doing this consciously, but I think subconsciously what they're doing is they mean they don't like the destination of the strategy, right? The strategy is bluntly to defeat the government wherever possible, hold on to as many people who want to reverse the referendum result as electorally possible, not lose any of their Leave voters, and end up with a form of Brexit that does not impede any of the policy aspirations of the Labour leadership. And bluntly, on that metric, Corbyn is playing a blinder. Unfortunately for me, I like the single market. I like the rule-based architecture of the EU. There are obviously things about it which are suboptimal and I would like to be changed, but I would prefer the UK to be a fully participant member of the European project. However, Corbyn doesn't want that, and he is doing, I do think weirdly, he's slightly helped by the fact a lot of the coverage of him is, oh, this old duffer has come up with a nonsense policy. And that means that the question becomes Corbyn duffer YN. Whereas if he was being covered in the way that, say, Gordon Brown's test for the euro, where basically everyone went, this is designed to both to frustrate joining the euro if the Treasury doesn't want to, but to facilitate it should, for some reason or another, those circumstances change. I think if Corbyn was being primarily covered through that lens, I don't think the game he's playing would be as effective. Of course, you can only beat what's in front of you, and you can only have a strategy for the media coverage you in fact get. But I do think that that's probably part of why it works for him.
Yeah, and you could see from even the front pages of today's papers, as you mentioned in Morning Call, it was on the front of The Guardian and the front of The Times, Jeremy Corbyn softens Labour's stance on Brexit. Whereas it wasn't on the front of any of the other papers that might be more antagonistic towards that position. So clearly, you know, the voters who want to see Jeremy Corbyn as more Europhile than he is, see those headlines, and then the others don't really see what he's doing. Or, like you say, they hear, oh, Europe thinks that this is a nonsense and you're just trying to have your cake and eat it, which they think all of our politicians are doing anyway.
Yeah, and I think one of the other, the question I do have about it, right, is it feels to me likely Labour will successfully defeat the government on the meaningful vote amendment, which is to have, you know, so obviously at the moment there's a commitment to a meaningful vote, but the meaningful vote as it's currently existed is actually a pretty meaningless vote.
Yeah, the meaningful vote commitment is a meaningless commitment.
Yeah, because at the moment the meaningful vote, basically the government can go our deal or the cliff, which is obviously not a meaningful decision. The meaningful vote amendment, and I think on the whole Keir Starmer's done a very good job in what is actually quite a difficult job, but the meaningful vote amendment is a little bit Keir Starmer realising that he cocked up pretty badly with the meaningful vote, and Labour effectively going back like control Z to make it an actually meaningful vote, which means the government can't go, which is it, the deal or the cliff?
Yeah. I think that has a very good chance of coming off.
I think that will come off for them, and I think the customs union will come off for them. And it is very easy to see a situation where, as a result of those votes, we end up in another election situation. Now, the question I then have for the Labour Party is one, whether or not this clever internal market fudge, which has the joy of being something and caps the number of EEA rebels of that core 50 of people who, slightly unfairly because of the actions of one or two people in that group, Chris Leslie, John Woodcock, have become seen as just difficult customers. It caps that rebellion at 50. However, and it's something which, if you're Caroline Flint or John Mann, you can broadly say you're into as well, right? It unites the various tribes of the PLP. Can it unite the various tribes of the PLP in an early election? Well, that's a lot more difficult. And what does it actually mean in practice if, let's say we do have an election in November 2018, Labour gains 15 more seats, Lib Dems gain 6 more seats. By the way, I'm talking about Labour gains in England, and then the SNP maybe lose another 6 seats to various parties. Well, weirdly, at that point, I think the leadership has a problem in that they don't want the EEA, but given that time will be running out, I think they will at that point probably have to go, the government's messed it up, here's an off-the-shelf model, I hear the EEA is lovely at this time of year. So the question I sort of still have, and I think the more interesting one than, you know, why isn't he trying to win a vote? He doesn't want to win and he can't win, is, rather like Keir Starmer's 6 tests, which were a brilliant form of words to get them through one crisis, but have now become this albatross because the 6 tests don't mean anything, is what happens if the gambit to force an early election works?
Yeah, because you can't go into an election with this fudge.
Yeah. It just would break down.
And also, I think it will have been proved when they put this amendment to Parliament, because there's no Tories who are going to vote with this Labour amendment. It's going to be proved to have been a sort of nonsense, isn't it, by the time of another election?
Yeah, I don't know. I think the thing is that Labour have got the advantage of two very strong brands that they're leveraging on this. The first is the overall Labour Party brand, which is, you know, nice but a bit soft, which means that actually, although it rightly annoys any EU wonk, regardless of whether or not they are a pro or anti-EU wonk, that they are basically going, you know what we'd be like? Tory position, but nicer. That is a sensible place for a Labour opposition to be, because people believe that about the Labour Party. The second thing is, because for most Remainers, I think Remain is actually about social liberalism, openness, yada, 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 all of which are things that to most social liberals Corbyn has in spades. And so they are successfully leveraging the success of their leader's brand and the success of the party brand to have this cake and eat it position. I think the difficulty, and maybe this is where I'm wrong about it not lasting through the heat of an election campaign, is my assumption is that the next election, there will be more questions of when you are prime minister, what will X mean? And not like, oh, this old tramp wandering around the country.
He'll be treated, unlike the previous election, he'll be treated more as a potential prime minister.
Yeah, and that does make it harder to leverage the strength of the Labour brand in the way that they're doing very effectively now. But the thing is, I say that will happen, but weirdly, I feel like people aren't taking Corbyn seriously yet, which is one of the things I did kind of think would happen after the June 2017 election, but it doesn't actually feel to me like that is happening. Am I being unfair?
No, I mean, we'll come to that in our You Ask Us segment, which will be looking back at that election. But I do agree with you. I think that even the fact that we've had this whole conversation about why Jeremy Corbyn isn't backing the UK to be in the EEA, you know, even that suggests that there's a level of not taking what he believes and how he does politics seriously.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
And now it's time for a section we like to call
You Ask Us.
Indeed, it is. Well, it isn't when we record, and it actually won't be when you listen to this, whether you are a paywall subscriber getting it this afternoon or you are a regular podcast listener getting it after Thursday at noon. But it will be the anniversary on Friday morning when, you know, those of you who just listen to it in your own sweet time, who disgust me here. No, we love all of you, even in our long tail. We'll be listening to it with the first anniversary of the 2017 general election. And we've got a lot of interesting questions about it, which I'm going to kind of wrap into a sort of micro one, which is looking back at that election, what do you think the kind of causes of that result were? Has the way you feel about that changed? And what about the last year has surprised you?
Yeah, well, I think one of the main narratives after the election was one about how austerity has gone too far. Even among Tory voices, they were all saying this, weren't they? And then, of course, you had the Grenfell fire soon after the election result that in the sort of narrative way that we cover politics, which is probably a bit glib, it kind of compounded that reaction to the election result. I've been surprised, because I've been doing a lot of reporting since then, about how little actually the Conservatives have done to try and mitigate what many of them see as the problem. Obviously, you do have Jeremy Hunt pushing for more money for the NHS, and it looks like that's going to happen. But I think in terms of the smaller things, in terms of things that affect people's everyday lives, there haven't been any sort of new funds released or any particularly anything with particular integrity in terms of putting more money into social housing, etc.
Yeah, I think I think the biggest surprise to me is in terms of the year gone, isn't there very rapidly was a kind of, a lot of talk on the Tory party about need to learn the lessons, yada, yada, yada. And there was an awful lot of, and I do think this is true, right, that austerity is politically supportable and very successful when you're going, some people, not you, but some people are going to have to suffer, but it'll be worth it in the end. People quite like that as a message, and they believe it because it buys into, in terms of how a household manages money, right? It's intuitively correct. The problem is that the other people having bad things happen to them, there are no cuts of that kind left. You can only start cutting into the Tory electoral base and into swing voters.
Yeah.
And even the cuts which don't affect those people directly, as everyone sees when they wonder, when they go about their own neighbourhood, and you must see even more starkly when you're out reporting on it. We all see homelessness in every city centre. We all see as we'll discuss in the next bit, potholes, and that kind of tattiness of the public realm. I similarly did think that the Conservative Party would have got into, I mean, not even necessarily the correct response on that, right? Because there are sort of two schools of thoughts. There's the kind of, we stopped making the argument for cuts.
But we're still doing
them. Yeah, but we're still doing them when we need to make the argument for them. And there was the, we've cut the bits that are politically survivable and we just need to stop with that now.
Yeah, yeah.
And weirdly, neither of those, not only has neither side won, that battle hasn't really happened. I guess partly because while Theresa May remains in place, they are ossified. That's been a surprise to me. And the other surprise to me is shortly after the election, I'm not sure if as much as, you know, obviously I love him to pieces because I'm, you know, a wet Blairite liberal, et cetera, et cetera. I'm not sure if Nick Clegg is a name to drop anymore. But the thing that Nick Clegg said afterwards, which has really stayed with me, is he said to me, like, yeah, in this election, Corbyn had a great deal of abuse and very little scrutiny. Now he's going to be taken seriously. He's going to be abused less, scrutinized a lot more. That's a very different challenge. Whether or not he can do it, who knows? Now, I really thought that was correct, then there would be considerably less of the kind of like... and the thing is, I can feel that some of our Corbyn skeptic listeners are already going to start angrily tweeting me, oh, but it's not abuse, it's true. The thing is that it's not about whether it's true or false. People switch off when they feel that the complaint is an insult. Mm. And he's friends with the West's enemies is an insult. It's not an argument, right? That is what most voters think when they hear those things. I mean, I really am leaning into how horrendously right-wing I am this episode, aren't I? But in Blair's biography, there's a whole bit where he talks about, you know, the insults that really damaged his opponents were not ones like, oh, you know, he's dangerous, oh, he's going to sell things off. It was, you know, William Hague, you know, he's good at, you know, tells good jokes, but he's not very good at, you know, judgment, or, you know, and doesn't have any actual plans. You know, Michael Howard's ideas from, you know, a bit out of touch. Yeah, you know, like those smaller criticisms that don't feel like the kind of thing a political partisan would say are just a lot more damaging. But weirdly, that hasn't happened. People still do cover Corbyn. And then, of course, there is just the straightforward abuse of covering him like he's kind of some weird duffer who floats around not knowing what he's doing. I mean, I don't know if you saw the Tracy Ullman sketch.
Oh, yeah.
Now, I think in a weird thing, the rancid racism that provoked in some quarters has weirdly rescued the fact that the show was appalling. Because I feel that a lot of the reviews afterwards, people felt a lot more inclined. You couldn't go, I mean, it was awful, because you had to go, for understandable reasons, look at these abhorrent responses to it. Mm. But it is completely wrong to see Corbyn as a man who is ashamed of his historical association, ashamed of the people he's allied with. He has an incredible fealty and loyalty to the people he's allied with, which is why he doesn't want to abandon them or let go of things. He has an incredible sense of personal loyalty. But that, I suppose, would hammer this idea people have of, you know, his critics seem to have him as a bit of an old duffer. And I think that's been a surprise to me.
Yeah, I've felt that's been surprising. And sort of any excuse to say, oh, look, he doesn't actually believe in insert X here of what I believe in, has returned. I think it went quiet a bit, and there was a bit more sort of normal coverage of him after the election, immediately after the election. But the moment that sort of Brexit came back onto the agenda and Labour had to start making decisions, again, anyone who maybe doesn't particularly care that much about the intricacies of our future relationship with the EU, but really doesn't like Jeremy Corbyn, was using him as a crutch, as you put it previously. And so I've been surprised that's it slipped into that kind of coverage so quickly again.
What's your sort of provisional hypothesis about what happened in June last year?
Oh, that's a good question. I think that potentially it's a big part of what Nick Clegg said to you about Jeremy Corbyn merely getting abuse and not scrutiny. We didn't really know much about what he stood for because so few of his policies were really being covered prior to the election campaign. And then as soon as he was on the road giving television interviews, but not much else, And you could see as well during election campaigns, the sort of problems in the swing seats that he was going to. You realise that actually he did have some answers in that manifesto that were really appealing to people. And I think that's what, there were a lot of people who were on the fence. And I think that's what changed people's minds about him at the last minute. That's my analysis. I had to do a piece, I think, just after the election on the manifesto and how it affected people on the doorstep. And that seemed to be a really big factor in it. People were on the fence until it came out.
Yeah. I do think that was a big part of it. I think the thing that it's very easy for us to forget is then as much as, you know, there's something, you know, but you still, every time I say it, I feel crazy saying it. Most people did not know much about Theresa May or Jeremy Corbyn in June 2017. They knew that she seemed like a kind of lady who was fairly on it, who'd backed Remain and now was implementing Brexit. And people liked that because they thought each other.
But
they
steady didn't, hand.
Yeah, they didn't really know anything about her. And ditto, they knew that like Labour was led by this like old guy who wasn't like previous Labour leaders, and Labour was quite divided. But they, again, didn't really know why.
Yeah.
And the Conservatives stood off, kind of convinced that the case against Corbyn had already been made. Corbyn had a brilliant campaign for video, a brilliant campaign for social media. You had the effects of you know, almost a decade of public spending being pared back. And you had a manifesto with a number of very popular elements. I kind of think that was what caused it. I think the fascinating thing about the next election is that I think those two things are kind of going to come in. Well, one, people now know who the two candidates are. The risk for the Tories is if they have a change, they have someone, you know, I think it's easy to forget, not least because she handled the campaign so well. Their next leader could still be worse than Theresa May from an electorate-facing perspective. But, you know, is Corbyn going to have, he's not going to have the kind of ability to introduce himself to people again. People now know who he is. However, the policy reason why he did well, fatigue with austerity, looks like it's going to get more acute. But the Conservative campaign will probably not be as dire as the last one. So I think you've got two kind of quite interesting forces pushing against each other whenever it happens.
Yeah, and I do think that the Conservatives could suffer a more acute problem than they did in the last election, that they won't have the numbers of people that Labour have going out and about canvassing, or, you know, working on their social media output, or even just their outriders, you know, people who aren't actually officially affiliated to the party but doing a lot of work to get their message out there. They're going to have even fewer of those people, even if they do have the policies that appeal more to young people than they did in their previous manifesto, because they don't have those young people. I mean, I remember doing a piece about the Tory membership crisis, and someone was saying, of the 10 people who bothered to turn up on your canvas, you know, 2 out of 10 of them will be dead by the next election. And they haven't shown much sign of changing that. They do have a sort of momentum parallel organization called Activate, but I don't think that it's got nearly as much of the numbers that Momentum has, and it didn't take off. And so I haven't seen that infrastructure change yet. And if there is an early election, then it certainly won't have changed. And I don't see how you can build that kind of support by the next election.
So, Anoush, you have just got back from being on the road reporting in Banbury.
Yes. So Banbury is a sort of commuter belt area in Oxfordshire. And, you know, there are signs that lead you to Chipping Norton there. So it's not exactly Labour territory, let's say. But yes, I went there to go and report on the pothole problem that has been plaguing the country for the past, most people will say the past 5 years, it has become really acute. And you now have instances where cyclists have been dying as a result of potholes in our roads that they haven't seen, and that have meant that they've fallen into traffic, or they've broken their backs, as someone recently did. And so it's really becoming a sort of human problem as well as a problem for motorists and insurance companies. And so that's part of this new series that we're doing in the magazine that I'm sure you, the listeners, have been reading, or at least have heard about, called Crumbling Britain, which is just trying to find the effects of austerity on day-to-day life And certainly I saw the effects of potholes on people's day-to-day life in Banbury, because I was basically bouncing up and down in the car that was taking me around, feeling very car sick by the end of it. So the problem here is that there's just been a complete underinvestment in our roads for so long, and that it's a very difficult thing to suddenly find a quick fix to, because the roads are 60, 70 years old, and roads only usually last about 10, 20 years.
So in your role as sort of crumbling correspondent, as you say, Banbury is somewhere which has pretty steadily re-elected the Conservative Party. You know, do people, when you were talking to people, do people make the connection between the fact that the roads are in a bad state and the economic policy choices made under the Conservative and Coalition government? Or do they, you know, is it kind of, are the potholes treated like the weather?
So that's a great question, because this is a big part of this series, is that I'm trying not to ask people, you know, is that because of the wicked Tories? I just want to hear what people say is a problem and say they think the reason for the problem is. And it does always come back to the funding. You know, it wasn't like this 10 years ago. They don't necessarily link it to the government. I mean, I've spoken to, in previous pieces, including in Somerset, I've spoken to mainly Tory voters and Tory councillors and town councillors, but they will still say this is a problem of funding that has started manifesting itself in the past 10 or 5 years. And what's that? That's a result of austerity. And so the person who was driving me around Banbury yesterday, Mr. Pothole is his name locally, he was saying, look, he's an independent person. He doesn't have a party affiliation. He was saying, look, potholes aren't political. They just need to be fixed. But then as we continued our conversation, it became increasingly clear that not only was it a lack of government funding to local councils that was causing this problem, which, you know, has gone massively down under the Conservatives and the Coalition previously, but it's also a result of private money coming into our road upkeep. So councils will hire contractors, and the contractors won't have enough people supervising what they do. And of course, it's all about the bottom line for them rather than public service. And so those two things are actually quite sort of left-wing arguments, but they're not given by left-wing people.
It's odd. Yeah, well, that was a very well answered, particularly seeing as I started gurning at you in this pained way when he was like, potholes aren't political. He's one of those things, whenever you do Vox Pop, obviously you can't, because it kind of ruins the colour piece if you go, and then I shook this person by the shoulders and went, why don't you think it's political? But it is kind of, would you say that was specific? Because obviously you've gone to places which, you know, usually vote Labour, you've gone to marginal places, and you've gone to a very sick. Would you say that that was a commonality across all of those trips, or was that more specific to Banbury?
I think it's a commonality from the trips that I've done, but let's not forget that I've been to mainly sort of conservative or swing areas so far. You know, when I've been to places like Wigan a long time ago for previous on the road pieces before the 2015 election, I think it was, there is a bit more of a party political sort of party loyalty sense in those kind of safe Labour seats, I think. I don't know if you've found the same thing when you've been out.
Yeah, no, I think that is definitely something I have encountered. I'm really fascinated as to, you know, I do occasionally have this thing where you leave somewhere and you think, gosh, if I had X million pounds of grant money to give to an academic, I would like them, you know, the thing I would like someone to do a proper study of is, because now in some cases, Liverpool feels to me the sort of most obvious example. You have a very strong civic culture and political awareness that you do not have, I think it's fair to say, in basically any other city in the UK. But the thing you have anywhere where you have a Labour council, then, you know, you see when you see it in posters, I see it in my own area, is you have a council which is mostly explicitly going, we are having to do this because the government is cutting our funding, right? Every time Hackney Council wants to build housing, which, I mean, it partly, of course, does because it has to justify why it's housing has such a small number of affordable units. But they kind of start with we aren't allowed to borrow. The government has cut our funding by X amount since 2010. As a result, this new development and this new school will have to be funded by private sector housing. And so I think it might, you know, I'm fascinated, obviously the answer is a bit of both, but I'm fascinated to know to what extent is it about a kind of civic culture of people being more aware of politics and being kind of more lefty with a small L? And to what extent is it because local government explicitly goes, this is a result of these cuts from the Tories over there?
Yeah, I think that is definitely a part of why people in some areas, Labour sort of majority areas, have more of that sense that this is, yes, there is that civic sense there, which means that those kind of leaflets from the council or justifications from the council can actually work because they can tap into a mentality that's already there. But I think there is that consciousness that they've taken, you know, Tory West is much easier story to tell as well for Wigan Council. You know, Tory Westminster has taken our money away. And so, you know, the market is half the size that it was here. And we don't have, you know, this, that and the other. And the high street is full of betting shops and, you know, payday lenders. It's much easier to tell that story than if you're a Tory council or you're not a Labour run council to say, the Tories have taken our money away, so we can't pay for you, because most of the time you are a Tory. So it's a more difficult story to tell. But I think it does spell trouble for the Conservatives that there are these areas where people just are quietly realising that something's been going on for quite some time, going wrong for quite some time. And even if they're not necessarily, you know, even if they're not necessarily your classic anti-austerity activists, they are. They are anti-austerity and they're experiencing it at the front line.
This week's podcast has been recorded by me, Stephen Bush, which is why the sound quality is so bad, and produced and rescued by our excellent producer, Caroline Crampton. Our music is Devil by the Devil, licensed under Creative Commons. And if you keep listening after the credits, you'll get to hear a special snippet of our culture podcast, The Back Half.
Hello, I'm Tom Gatty.
And I'm Kate Mossman. And you're about to hear a clip from The Back Half, the New Statesman's culture podcast, every fortnight.
Search iTunes for The Back Half or go online, acast.com/The Back Half. See you there. So, Kate, our non-anniversary this week, 18 years ago... Is it 18 years? Yeah, 18 years ago this week, what happened?
Gladiator hit the screens. This is not a non-specific, non-important cultural event, because this was a huge cultural event.
Although, having said that, when I told Claire, my wife, that we were doing Gladiator, she was like, oh, great, can't wait. And then it emerged that she thought I was talking about Gladiators.
That's true.
The TV series.
Well, we could do that another week. Yeah. That's then, and that prefigured Gladiator, yeah, didn't it? We went, my entire floor at university went to see this at the Odeon Tottenham Court Road. It was the first time I laid eyes on Joaquin Phoenix as the Elvis resembling, snivelling, incestuous, sadistic Commodus. The emperor who was thought to have brought about the fall of Rome, or begun the fall of Rome. I found out that Jack Gleeson modelled Joffrey in Game of Thrones on Joaquin Phoenix.
That makes total sense. Yeah, yeah.
Brilliant, brilliant performance. I think his first line in it is he runs up to some battlefield where extremely bloody battle has just taken place, and he goes, "Am I too late, Father? Did I miss the battle?" And it just goes downhill from there. It's absolutely brilliant. Apparently, Mel Gibson was offered the lead role of Maximus, Russell Crowe's part, and turned it down because he said he was too old. Thank God it wasn't Mel Gibson.
Yeah, that would have been a totally different film. Yeah. Oh, was that pre or post Braveheart? I get post Braveheart.
I think it was just post Braveheart. Yeah.
I guess maybe that made him the obvious choice for another sort of sword wielding historical figure. I've just got one sort of interesting fact about Gladiator. Shall I do it now? Which I discovered when I was, this isn't, other people know this, it's not knowledge that only I am privy to. But when I interviewed Nick Cave a few years ago, I was reading his novels and doing a bit of research, and I discovered that he had written a script for a sequel to Gladiator, Gladiator 2. Russell Crowe had approached Nick Cave directly to write the sequel, and Nick Cave sort of said, "Yeah, I'm kind of interested. Didn't you die? You know, didn't you die at the end? Did I miss the ending, or wasn't that you dying?" And he's like, "Yeah, you work that out." So Cave wrote this. I wonder whether there's a version of this circulating somewhere in Hollywood. But Cave wrote a version of this where the Maximus character goes down to purgatory and then the gods are all dying out because this Christ figure has come to earth.
Wow.
And the many sort of Greek and Roman gods are really suffering. And so they send Maximus down to kill Christ.
Oh my God.
And his followers.
Was Christ going to be played by Mel Gibson?
Cave wanted, so this was going to be called Gladiator 2, Christ Killer.
No.
Yes.
Is that real?
Yeah. Well, this is what Nick Cave says anyway. Maybe he's having us all on. But Russell Crowe's talked about it as well, and Ridley Scott.
Crowe was, sorry, go on.
Then the bit I always remember for this is like, so that's the kind of setup. And then he becomes this sort of eternal, like endlessly replicating warrior. And so the last 20 minutes of Cave's script has him, this Maximus character, just fighting in every war in history, like up to Vietnam. Anyway, wow. Ridley Scott said it was a brilliant piece of work, but no one would ever touch it.
So I found out that Russell Crowe was continually unhappy with the screenplay by William Nicholson, and he kept rewriting parts of it, and he would strop off the set. And there's a famous line in there where he goes, "I will have my vengeance in this life or the next." And he initially refused to say it. And he told William Nicholson, "Your lines are garbage, but I'm the greatest actor in the world and I can make even garbage sound good." And I thought, so what else did William Nicholson do? Because this obviously wasn't a very good relationship between the pair of them. William Nicholson did the screenplay for Les Miserables, which Russell Crowe was the lead in. So this, maybe they actually love each other.
Yeah.
This is just a kind of eternal fight between the two of them throughout their careers. But yeah, I don't think he was particularly easy to get on with. I just want to watch it again now, but it's long, and I think that now that I'm in the age of two screening or three screening, I'm not sure if I could focus for the entire time.
You could focus. I rewatched the ending, I have to say, which is his death scene, where it kind of goes into this sort of Instagram filter world.
Yeah.
Of the ancient,
so a lot of blue filter
wheat fields of Elysium, where he goes and meets his wife and children.
I think it invented the slow motion battle as well.
Did it?
Yeah, like the opening battle scene is in a field in Surrey that was set for deforestation, and Surrey Council were just like, "You can burn it if you want." So they just slashed it and burned it. And for some reason it became blurry, so they then turned it into slow motion, but it was an accident or something. And then you just see that everywhere now, and you see they also thought, and I've heard some rock star say this the other day, that the Colosseum was too small. So that's why they CGI'd it. They were disappointed by this puny little Colosseum.
I'll tell you where you saw that.
Where was that?
You saw it in a review that we published in the New Statesman magazine, which we both work on, of the memoir of YouGod of the Wu-Tang Clan. There's one bit where he goes to the Colosseum and he just writes about how disappointing it was. He thought it was going to be massive, but it was more like a little league stadium.
Well, he's not the only one, because Ridley Scott was disappointed. So that's why they build this massive one. And to this day, people who go to see the Colosseum are disappointed because they've seen Gladiator. They think it's going to look like that.
Yeah, he specifically referenced Gladiator. He's like, I was on this Hollywood idea of what the Colosseum looked like. So
it's done a lot of damage.
Lies. It's just post-truth began with Gladiator in May 2000. But I think we're probably both going to go away and rewatch it.
We had the soundtrack on CD.
Hans Zimmer. It's a good working soundtrack, actually. We often talk about working music, but
yeah.
Claire works.
Because it's sort of shapeless singing as well, isn't it? It's like it's
Happy non-anniversary at Gladiator.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.